Hey everyone, it's been a crazy past few days, and getting the chance to ask Madeleine Albright in a room of 800 plus people if she still defends her 1996 statements, it was worth it. So that's why I didn't put on an episode yesterday, but instead you'll get two episodes today. Following this episode, I talked to Dr. Walter Block and discussed the life of Murray Rothbard. Have any of you ever wondered, what did Murray Rothbard's apartment look like? His favorite music? His controversy with the Koch brothers? In the interview I did with Walter, we discussed things that I know for a fact most people don't know about. So don't miss that episode and come celebrate the life of Murray Rothbard with us. But today we're talking about how the state transcends its limits. And what we're ultimately talking about is how governments establish their legitimacy. And I'll preface this entire discussion with a short story. I met this one girl who called herself a libertarian a while back. And to be fair, she's very young, fresh out of high school. I think to start, I was more impressed with how intelligent she was, but at the same time, some of the things she was saying confidently were repeated lies. So we sat down and discussed libertarianism, and throughout the discussion, I was talking about the illegitimacy of government, and she sat there and looked offended. She wanted to talk about how politicians are good people and we just need to infiltrate the system. Now, first off, of course, I was the one that was actually offended of the former part of her statement. Look, surely people like Ron Paul are respectable in that his actions were a reflection of his words. And if we're being completely honest, Ron Paul was nothing like a politician. Incredibly human, incredibly genuine. So I'm not talking about the few people like the Pauls and Thomas Massey, or as Dave Smith is quoted as saying on Kennedy, there are three good people and you've had them all on your show. I'm talking about pretty much everyone else. And it's not as if people like me and you don't exist, assuming you're watching this and cherish the true values of liberty. But it is true that most people who enter into politics, even with good intentions, are easily corruptible. There is no one wise enough to rule your life. I'll say it again. No one is wise enough to rule your life. And I just have to throw this out here. For the people who think they're being smart by saying, oh, you don't even believe there should be parents because they have control over their kids' lives. Well, when we're talking about libertarianism, we're not talking about a philosophy for whales. We're not talking about a philosophy for kids. We're talking about a philosophy for human adults. So let's start this off. I'm quoting the first sentence of this chapter. As Bertrand de Jouvenel has sagely pointed out, throughout the centuries, men have formed concepts designed to check and limit the exercise of state rule. And one after another, the state, using its intellectual allies, has been able to transform these concepts into intellectual rubber stamps of legitimacy and virtue to attach to its decrees and actions. So remember, government has a monopoly to act in ways that, if were done by private citizens like you and me, would be deemed criminal. For example, let's say there was a wild animal running around my neighborhood and it was causing havoc, trash cans knocked over, tires gouged, whatever. It's a menace. From there, let's say I went and personally took care of the problem and then left a bill on everybody's doorstep. My logic would be this: I've done for you all a service that is objectively observable. Whether or not you were even aware of the problem or cared, you will now be paying me to show that you're fulfilling your moral obligation into the system that provides services for you. So that's the analogy, and the next sentence is even more telling. The concept of parliamentary democracy began as a popular check upon absolute monarchical rule. It ended with parliament being the essential part of the state and its every act totally sovereign. De Jouvenel, who, by the way, was a 20th century French philosopher and economist, wrote a book called On Power, which I'll link to. And another thing I want to point out for you readers out there, look at the footnotes. Believe it or not, sometimes the actual book you're reading is not even half the story. But scholars like Murray, who just read an incredible amount, always paved the way with their extensive footnotes. Now, De Jouvenel said this: many writers on theories of sovereignty have worked out one or the other of these restricted devices. But in the end, every single such theory has, sooner or later, lost its original purpose and come to act merely as a springboard to power by providing it with the powerful aid of an invisible sovereign with whom it could fully, in time, identify itself with. And he was dead on. This is a common theme you see in both communist and fascist regimes of the 20th century. And with communists, they envisioned the state as being the collective of the workers. And fascists viewed the state as being an embodiment of one great leader. So the laws of the commune were the will of the workers, and the laws of the fascist regimes were the will of the people. What's the difference? Now, Charles Black, who was a well-known professor, he taught for nearly five decades, said this in 1960 in his book, The People and the Court. And I'm partially quoting what Murray did to save time. A man is drafted, though he finds nothing in the Constitution about being drafted. He believes and he discovers that some respectable lawyers believe with him that the government has no more right to tell him how much wheat he can grow than it has to tell him whom his daughter can marry. And he goes on to say, a man goes to the federal penitentiary for saying what he wants to, and he paces his cell reciting, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. A businessman is told what he can ask, and he must ask for buttermilk. And Murray sums up the danger of the state in one beautiful sentence. This danger is averted by the states propounding the doctrine that one agency must have the ultimate decision on constitutionality, and that this agency, in the last analysis, must be part of the federal government. And look, you hear people say that religion is the root of all evil, and I have friends who are atheists, but the most evil religion of all is the one that glorifies the state. Hands down. Once all the facts are out in the open, they are hard to praise for anything. Another professor mentioned was J. Allen Smith, and he drove the point that if the federal government is a check on the power of the states, who is a check on the power of the federal government? And we're talking realistically and not in regards to what was intended. Sure, there was supposed to be powers in check to limit federal power, but keep in mind, your old buddy FDR signed off on nearly 3,100 executive orders in his time. So the desired course of history and history itself are two completely different things, and that's apolitical to say. And the quote by Smith was, it was assumed by the people that the new government could be permitted to determine the limits of its own authority, since this would make it, and not the Constitution, supreme. Now, people like John C. Calhoun and Adam Smith, despite some of their fatal errors in their thinking, had the idea of what's called a concurrent majority, and the idea was to allow the minority parties to reverse the oppression placed against them. And Murray points out that the logic of all this, which would supposedly limit federal power if nullification were used, you wouldn't have these abuses of power, starting even back to George Washington, if the logic followed. Now, Murray says, why stop with the states? Why not place veto power in counties, cities, wards? Furthermore, interests are not only sectional, they are also occupational, social, etc. What if bakers or taxis or any other occupation? Should they not be permitted a veto power of their own lives? In short, he says, Calhoun does not push his path-breaking theory on concurrence far enough. He does not push it down to the individual himself. Another knockout quote I love is, for one thing, just as the right of nullification for a state logically implies its right of secession, so a right of individual nullification would imply the right of any individual to secede from the state under which he lives. You can imagine this is like nails on a chalkboard for people to defend those who carry political clout. I'll end this discussion quoting again from De Juvenel. Whether it is socialist or whether it is not, power must always be at war with the capitalist authorities and despoil the capitalists of their accumulated wealth. In doing so, it obeys the laws of its nature. Thank you all. Be sure to watch the episode right after this where I talk to Walter Block. It's one of my favorite interviews I've ever done, ever. You guys are going to love it. See you guys later. Hey, everyone. Please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.